It is a great honor and a pleasure for me to introduce this year's Holberg Laureate, Professor Juan Martinez Alier. He is Professor Emeritus at Universitat Autonoma de Barcelona, UAB, in the Department of Economics and Economic History. In recommending Juan Martinez Alier for the Holberg Prize, the Holberg Committee notes that he is a world-leading scholar of ecological economics, political ecology, and environmental justice. The enticing title of Professor Martinez Alier's Holberg Lecture is Land, Water, Air, and Freedom. Juan Martinez Alier, the floor is yours.
Thank you very much for this introduction, which is very generous, and what I like most of this text is are the words analytically clear. So that's what I hope to be in the next 45 minutes, to be analytically clear and to make the points I want to make in a way that everybody can understand. I bring together in my work, as has been said already, ecological economics, political ecology, and environmental justice, relying to a large extent on the environmental justice atlas, in which there are almost 4,000 entries, and it's a collective work, of course. Nobody can do so many entries in an atlas, collective work of perhaps over 100 people. And this atlas gives a lot of evidence about environmental conflicts. Because as the industrial economy grows, there is growth and changes in the social metabolism, meaning the flows of energy and materials entering, but also exiting the economy as inputs they enter and as waste they go out, carbon dioxide, for instance. The industrial economy is not circular at all, it is entropic. So we could say that we are obviously in the Anthropocene, but we are also in the Entropocene. Entropy, Anthropocene from the word entropy. Even today, however, economists and other social scientists are reluctant to use the indicators that come from the environmental field. For instance, they do not study systematically the ROI, the energy, energy return on the energy input. It's still a novelty to them, to economists in general, or economic historians, and they do not study, they do not incorporate, I'm talking about mainstream economists and mainstream social scientists or historians, they do not use other indicators, like, for instance, the human appropriation of net primary production of biodiversity, which is abbreviated as the HAM. And these indicators and many others, like the planetary boundaries indicators, for instance, or the carbon dioxide concentration in the atmosphere, or these kind of indicators, are needed to understand human history, recent human history, but also ancient human history, and to understand the future, isn't it? Therefore, a large part of the human, of the social sciences, including economics, very especially, are not very useful, in my view, to understand what is going on in the relation of humans and the environment. And human history cannot be written without knowledge of the social metabolism, another concept from ecology, such as, for instance, biological invasions, as happened when the Europeans reached America and caused a population degrowth of great proportions. You cannot explain this with the social sciences. So we need, like we said already today, to yesterday, we need an orchestration of the sciences, or a choreography of the different sciences. Orchestration of the sciences was a quotation from Otto Neurath. Economics students, therefore, students, young students of economics or business economics, should spend, in my view, the first semester studying solar energy, the carbon and the water cycles, the evolution of life and photosynthesis, and then the stocks of photosynthesis in the fossil fuels, the discovery of agriculture, the growth of population, but they do not do this in economics. In the first semester, they are already introduced to the study of markets and prices. They do not learn, therefore, about the entropy law and the economic process, which is the title of a book by Georgescu Regan of 1971. Nowadays, we see that the amount of fossil fuels entering the economy and at the same time new materials used perhaps for the energy transition or the electrical transition. So both the energy and the materials entering the economy is increasing. And these materials come from what we call in political ecology or in environmental history, the commodity extraction frontiers. And there is also exit outputs of waste, of which polluted water and excessive production of carbon dioxide are in amount, in volume, the main ones. And therefore, there are social conflicts that arise from this excessive or this search for the commodities, of new commodities, or more quantities of the old commodities like coal, oil, gas, and so on, from the frontiers of extraction, and also from the pollution side. And such conflicts explain that there is a counter-movement, a social counter-movement that we call environmental justice. And this is spreading around the world, and we can have examples, show examples from this country, for instance, and from any other country and place in the world, as we do to some extent later. And we say that there is a world movement, or perhaps movements, for environmental justice because the causes are similar. To simplify, the increase and changes in the social metabolism. The repertoires of action, repertoires of contention, are similar. The outcomes are also similar. Sometimes these movements fail, but sometimes they have successes and they stop some projects, isn't it? As has happened not so long ago in this country, in several instances, like, for instance, the Lofoten Islands, leaving the oil or the gas under the sea. So there are many similarities that justify the idea that as a hypothesis, there is a world movement for environmental justice. Of course, this movement is not only in the south of the planet, it is only in the north. In the north by young people, as you know, mainly, until a few years ago at least, they were very active, but also I think it's mainly in the south. In the north, we could call this movement the degrowth movement. In the south, the global south, if you go to India, or you go to South Africa, or you go to Brazil, and preach degrowth, nobody is going to agree with you, to put it plainly. They're going to say, what a strange word and what a strange doctrine you are preaching to poor people, isn't it? But if in the south pipelines are stopped, mines sometimes are stopped, eucalyptus plantations sometimes are stopped, all these are examples of what I call degrowth in practice. So one of the main ideas of what I'm going to say is about degrowth in practice. Second point I want to make is the title of the talk. The title, as Bjorn said, is a bit, you didn't say strange, you said enticing. You could say old-fashioned, because land and freedom is a very old slogan coming from agrarian movements, coming from Eastern Europe, from Russia. Assemblea Ivolia was incorporated, well, in many places around the world, in peasant wars or peasant struggles. In Mexico, for instance, in 1910, Zapata made the revolution under the slogan Tierra y Libertad, Land and Freedom. I think that Zapata himself could have added water, land, water, and freedom, because the fight in Morelos in Mexico was about recuperating the land from the haciendas, at the same time stopping the use of water in sugarcane plantations, because there was a big increase in sugarcane production under Porfirio Díaz, and therefore the poor people were expropriated of the land and expropriated of the water. So we could have this slogan of land, water, and freedom, but air should be added, because sometimes air is polluted, or sometimes air becomes like a new raw material for the windmills. So that's the explanation of the title and a book which I am almost about to publish, which is called Land, Water, Air, and Freedom. The freedom part comes from the view that if you lose access to water, access to land, and the water is the air is polluted, or you have windmill farms like the Fosen one in Norway against Sami people, you are losing the freedom that would come from the fact that you can use nature for your own, I wouldn't say growth of the economy, but rather would say with Amartya Sen, for the deployment of your capabilities, isn't it? So when I use freedom, I am using freedom in a kind of Amartya Sen sense, or Martha Nussbaum sense of capabilities. But they have not emphasized this idea that capabilities decrease when people lose access to the environment. So why there are so many conflicts? Well, I have already explained some of it, but now I am going to show some of the figures about this. Well, first I wanted to show this, which in an homage to Holberg, this, the first thing is the statue in Copenhagen near the European Environment Agency, which I saw many times visiting the agency without knowing who Holberg was. Now I know more or less. And the second is self-explanatory. It's made 2 days ago here in Bergen. So thanks Holberg and the Holberg Committee and the tradition of Holberg in this country and in the region. This is what I want to show. This is not from Holberg's time. This more recent kind of graphic, and it's about the increase in the carbon dioxide in the atmosphere in the last, as you see. When I started to talk about this, was about the year 92, much later than I should have started, but I was an economist, so I didn't know anything about this, and has grown from 360 parts per million in 92 to 420 parts per million, and it's going to grow to 450 parts per million, with no doubt about it, and perhaps even to 500 parts per million at the end of the century or before. The next one, this is called the killing curve, that everybody should in this room knows, but not perhaps everybody outside the room. And this is about whether carbon dioxide, who is producing the carbon dioxide, on the other hand, who is suffering from the climate change without being responsible. So the upper thing says that 49% of the carbon dioxide, excessive carbon dioxide, no, the plants are producing. I mean, we're talking about human intervention in the carbon cycle. 49% is produced by 10% of the richest people, and you can see the graphic yourselves. So there is a global effect, increase in the greenhouse effect, but not everybody, as I wrote here, is in the same boat. No? We are not all in the same boat. The following one is about another trend, which is the trend in the use of primary energy. And as you see, there is no substitution of one energy form of energy for another. So far, there is an addition. To think that the coal, oil, and gas are going to degrow by 50% for net zero of carbon dioxide before the year, I don't know what they say, 2030, is just a figment of the imagination. It's just fiction and not reality. This is not going to happen unless the world economy degrows very considerably. It's also true that another trend, which I have not drawn here, is the world population growth. And this is stopping around the world, including northern India, and not yet all of Africa. The world population has decided, collectively, the women of the world have decided to have less children. And this is something that, of course, started already many years ago, this kind of decision. But this has spread everywhere now. I think this is a good trend because the world population grew 4 times in the 19th century. In the past century, in the 20th century, grew 4 times in the past century. And in this century, it's going to grow only 50%, more or less. No, from 6 billion to 6 billion to 8.5 or 9 billion, and then it will stop during the lifetime of the younger people in the room. And the next trend, which is very similar to the energy trends, is something that comes here, says European Environment Agency, but in fact it comes from Marina Fischer-Kowalski group in Vienna, from Helmut Havel, people who started to do this kind of accounting 20 or 30 years ago without any success, and then now, of course, are copied by the international organizations. Well, it's a sign of success of the methodology they use to count the tons entering the economy from biomass. Biomass is one of the bottom part, or from fossil fuels, or from the metals, and also from sand and gravel that go mostly for the cement industry and for infrastructures. As you see, there is no sign. If one would prolong this to a bit further, we would see that when there is the pandemic, it goes back a little bit down and then goes up again. So the average per person per year is about 12 tons of materials, 12 tons per person. So any in the room, we are all a little bit above this probably. And because there are big differences between rich and poor, isn't it? And very little of this is recycled. You think of sand and gravel for cement, this is not recycled. Perhaps in the long run, but not for the next 20 or 30 or 40 or 200 years. If you think of the fossil fuels, which is another component of this, the fossil fuels, they are recycled 0%. They are burned, and they are burned forever. Of course, they produce carbon dioxide and other particles and so on, but the energy cannot be used twice. See? So this is sort of the physical realities of the world economy. And all this produces a lot of pressure on the environment, isn't it? A lot of pressure on the environment that we could also see if we look at the planetary boundaries that mostly in Sweden, a group in Sweden has been doing for the last 10 or 15 years, including Stefan from Australia, who died a few months ago, and he was one of the main driving forces in this establishment of the planetary boundaries that many of you have heard about or know, and which is, they are another set of indicators quite similar to the one I have shown up to now, material flows and energy. So because of the these trends on population, which I think is favorable, trends on material flows and energy, which I think are a disaster for the environment and for our future as humans. Trends on the biodiversity as such, the hump I have not shown, but the human appropriation of production of biomass is also increasing, isn't it? Because meat consumption, but also biofuels and so on. And this is not a good trend. So despite, I said, that some trends perhaps are improving, in general, they are not improving from the environment point of view. They are deteriorating. They go together with economic growth. The more economic growth, the worse for the environment, to simplify a point, isn't it? And therefore, because of this pressure, I will go back to the simplification that what is bad for the environment is good for the economy. But in general, I leave it at that for the moment. And I go to just make another point about environmentalist movements. Because I think it's the pressure on the environment, the different kinds of pressure on the environment, that has given rise to different sorts of environmental movements. And in my book of 20 years ago, with Ramachandra Aguja, from 25 years ago, from Bangalore, from India, we established a doctrine about environmental movements that many people quote, and it says that there are three types of environmental movements. One is the environmentalist conservationists, that Ram called the cult of wilderness, like almost a religion of the conservation of nature. One proposal now is to leave 30% of the surface of the world and the oceans for wild biodiversity, so we are only going to use 70%, and this one proposal which was made recently. So the cult of wilderness, of wildlife. The second line is what I call myself the gospel, because we kept into a religion terminology, the gospel of eco-efficiency, which all of you know, because this was predominant in Europe, in the European Union documents, and for a very long time has been the mainstream, I think, type of environment, saying we can grow, we can have economic growth, and at the same time, we can have environmental protection through, for instance, changes in technology on the one hand, and also economic policies, taxes or permits, paying for pollution permits and so on. This I call the gospel, a bit ironically, clearly, the gospel of eco-efficiency, because those who believe in this are really have a kind of faith that this will work, isn't it? But it is not working. And the third branch of the environmental movement is what we call, with Ramgua already 25 years ago, the environmentalists of the poor. And this morning I was saying that now I have changed a little bit this, or I have repented a little bit of the environmentalists of the poor, and now I would call it the environmentalists of the poor and the indigenous, because the indigenous people are very much, very often, the protagonist in this kind of environmental complaints. They are a protagonist in the main, the one that has more future is the environmentalist of the poor and the indigenous, I think. To change the way that the economy is driving the environmental indicators. I think, as you know, and has been mentioned by the Halbert Committee when they gave me the prize, is that there is a school in Europe, or a movement, I would say, both an academic school and a movement for degrowth. And I know this very well because I belong to this, and also I saw it growing. I saw it, well, being born and prospering, this school of degrowth, which in my view comes in part from the 70s already, from authors in France like Latouche and other people, and from the publication in 79, or a book by Georges Courregen in French with the title Des mains la décroissance, and quite often I say now aujourd'hui la décroissance, because it is aujourd'hui, it is now the décroissance, that degrowth has arrived intellectually. Because from Georges Courregen we had the steady state economy from Herman Daly, then we had prosperity without growth from Tim Jackson, managing without growth from Peter Victor. All these are ecological macroeconomists. And now we have Georgios Kallis, Jason Hickel, or Julia Steinberger, and many other people, younger people, thinking that they belong to the degrowth movement in Europe, and also producing a lot of interesting academic things and getting big research money, as they have done with the Synergy grant recently and given to Georgios Kallis and others, precisely at the ICTA UAV, with the name Research on Post-Growth, because they thought that research on degrowth was a bit too much, and they said post-growth, but they meant degrowth. So degrowth is going up, is growing, which is a bit paradoxical. But all the degrowth people will say, we're not against growth of everything. We are in favor of growth of agroecology, for instance, growth of alternative energy. So we're for growth of degrowth, of the degrowth movement, but not growth of the economy. Isn't it? The economy, because why? Not because it's not a religion. We are reasoning in the Holberg style of reasoning, as enlightened people that we are, that growth of the economy means more energy, fossil fuel energy, more pollution, less biodiversity, and all these indicators. Nevertheless, the obsession with economic growth remains firm. Probably in the Norwegian government, they would not agree with the degrowth program, or at least this is what happens in general in the world. Going back to 1987, which was the year that my first book on the environment was published, as Björn mentioned, by coincidence, another book was published, much more popular and famous, which was the Brundtland Commission report on sustainable development, isn't it? Which was, I think, a defense of Keynesian social democracy against the environmental challenge from people like Georges Courregen, H.T. Odum, Barry Commoner, books published in 71, but also the challenge from the Limits to Growth report to the Club of Rome that the Meadows had written. And this was also very popular, the Meadows report to the Club of Rome. It is still very popular. And a counter argument was put forward by the UN, what we call colloquially the Brundtland Commission. Isn't it? I know that this has some Norwegian connotations, isn't it? But when they say this is a reaction from Keynesian social democracy, I think I am right in saying this, because Keynesianism during the 30s and 40s had been an economic theory to get out of economic crisis by public expenditure and deficit spending, but quite early on with Harrod and Domar and so on, which is the macroeconomics that I studied as a young person of 25, 26 years old, the macroeconomics coming from Keynes, all this became a doctrine or a theory of economic growth. Isn't it? And we're going to go into the economic theory details. But you would admit, isn't it, that in the 60s until 75 or so, 50s and 60s in the West, the doctrine of Keynesian-driven economic growth dominated, in which the state had a big role, and then came, of course, a phase of neoliberalism. So the doctrine, when we say sustainable development, this can be criticized in two parts. First part, we can criticize development. second part will criticize sustainable. Development means meant to the eyes of some people, mostly from the South, already around in the 80s, that all the countries in the world were being to be classified into the developed ones, okay, and the underdeveloped ones, the third world. And people like Arturo Escobar, Gustavo Esteva, and other people published a famous book, Wolfgang Sachs, especially was the editor, which is called, I can't remember, but I think it's called The Development Dictionary. And now there is like a second edition, edited by Ashish Kothari and Federico de Maria, Alberto Acosta, Ariel Chalet. A very popular book has become. It was published 2 or 3 years ago. It has many quotations on the metrics of quotations. It's doing very well, which is called, I can't remember, the Post-Development Dictionary. And they criticize development being this doctrine of modernization, sort of modernization for all countries in the world, which has been preached by the World Bank and the IMF and so on for so long, isn't it? So there was a criticism of the world development in which we, the ecological economists, did not participate as much as we should, because we criticized the sustainable part. Sustainable part was like saying that you could have economic growth and this would be sustainable. And people like Herman Daly or Robert Goodland, very early on, after 87, they said this is an oxymoron, this is a contradiction, you cannot have sustainable economic growth. Why? Because of the indicators which I have already shown. Isn't it? Therefore, the ecological economics has, from the very beginning, been skeptical about sustainable development, and then this has led to this ecological macroeconomics and this kind of growth of the notion of degrowth which we see at present, but not so much on the concept of development, in which the criticism has come more from, say, anthropology or from these writers I mentioned before, Gustavo Esteva, Arturo Escobar, Ashish Kothari, who is much younger, people like this. So development, again, to come to the title of the talk, if we go back to Amartya Sen and think of his famous book, Development as Freedom, which Martha Nussbaum, who also got one of these prizes, has elaborated and written a lot about it, and very interesting writing, of course, with this notion of capabilities. But if the Amartya Sen critique of development as economic growth, as growth in the GDP, if this has had a practical result, has been to introduce other indexes, like the Index of Human Development, isn't it? If you look at the Index of Human Development, which is different from GDP per capita, it correlates very closely with GDP per capita across countries. And the Index of Human Development, the Index of Human Development, doesn't say anything at all about the environment. Because nobody has invented yet, and I think one can invent this kind of index, in which the environment, the economy, and the social welfare, and so on, are all measured in a single number. This, I think, cannot be done. Cannot be done because one thing goes up when the other goes down. Therefore, I mean, yeah, Costa Rica is going to be in the middle and therefore is going to be in the top of the index. But what does it mean? I mean, it is not a guide for any policy. The Sustainable Development Goals, which are now like official doctrine, coming from the UN, make still again the same mistake in my view as the Brundtland Commission with sustainable development, because the sustainable development goals, which are very praiseworthy and very interesting and plausible, most of them have one defect, or one main defect, which is number 8. And number 8, to summarize, says decent work, meaning decent wage work, not work in general, decent work and economic growth. I don't know how this came about. I suppose it was a compromise in the UN on what the Sustainable Development Goals should say, and somebody said, no, lead growth apart. And the other people said, how can we do this, isn't it? And at the end they said that the Sustainable Development Goals of today, the official doctrine from the UN, includes number 8, in which it says explicitly that one goal is economic growth in general for everybody, for China, for India, for Norway, and so on. Therefore, this is something that, well, that I criticize and we criticize, because the reality, and now I change the argument, the reality of the economy today, to go back to the entropy law, is that now we have figures, and the figures I show about the materials in the economy, that this one here, as you see in the vertical axis, is my, say, 100. 100 billion means 100,000 million. A milliarden, and this means, like I said, 12 tons per capita, and it's going up. If you look at this 10 billion tons entering the economy every year, or almost 100 billion tons entering the economy each year, divided into these categories, mean 12 per person, per year, and of this, what is recycled is 1 ton, more or less. So 8% of what comes into the economy is recycled according, well, even to, again, to the European Environment Agency that has copied this from other information, because this comes from articles by Vicky Haas from the Vienna Group, again, from the Marina Fischer-Kowalski Institute. But anyway, it's easy to calculate. I mean, we have to calculate energy, recycling of energy, zero. Recycling of sand and gravel, well, we have an estimate. Recycle of biomass, which is easy to recycle in a way, but of course we use a lot of biomass. Only this year biomass is current photosynthesis. It's not fossil photosynthesis, it's current one. But we use it as fuel, as food. If you think on our own human metabolism of the food that we eat, about 10 megajoules per day per person, and you calculate how is this recycled, isn't it? I mean, well, a lot is dissipated in our movement to keep the heat of the body, isn't it? And the others are excrements that are not usually recycled as matter. So the energy is dissipated, and so on. And a lot of the biomass, of course, does not go for the endosomatic energy to feed people, but to feed animals, who will then become used by humans as meat or, you know, as biofuels, biofuels. So how large is then the circularity gap, or how large it is the metabolic, the entropy hole, if you like. I know they use this in astronomy, but they use it in a more terrestrial sense. Or the metabolic rift, as somebody says, that Marx already used, but in a different, much smaller context, isn't it? So how large is the circularity gap? Well, you can say about 90%, 92%. Is this going down? No, it is going up every year, because it's still a little bit of economic growth, a little bit of population growth, but not much, and also because more fossil fuels enter in the economy even this year. Carbon emissions are going up, and they have to come down. And they're going up because we're burning more oil, gas, and here in the audience, I think, is Brototi Roy from India, who has an article with Anke Shafarchik, which is called India Transition to Coal, because this is what is happening in India. Of course, it's transitioning to everything. More coal, more solar energy, more windmills, you know, because the economy is growing, but it's increasing the use of coal. So the circularity gap is also shown in international trade. And there is a recent article by Infante Amate, Arturo Urrego, people from Latin America, looking over 100 years of the terms of trade of Latin America, or South America, really, with the rest of the world. So the title of the article is The Open Veins of Latin America. And then, of course, a subtitle showing that they are not in the humanities and no literature, that they are in the ecological economics. And I know them very well. And they said, we had great difficulty keeping this title, because the journal said, what is this kind of title, The Open Veins of Latin America, which comes, of course, in Latin Americans in the Room, from Eduardo Galeano, literally interesting book that he published with this title, I don't know, 30, 40 years ago. And what they show is this, that Latin America is exporting many more tons of material that it is importing, and that nevertheless, sometimes at least, in monetary terms, the exports are not able to pay for the imports, because the exports are cheap and the imports are more expensive. And therefore, this is something that we know has been happening, but it fits with this idea from Latin America, from Maristela Svampa, Alberto Acosta, which I already mentioned, Eduardo Gudinas, of a movement, an ecological, economic, political movement, which I think is growing if we look what is happening in Colombia, against the extractivist, what they call the extractivist economy. Look at the soybeans from Argentina, iron ore from Brazil. They export 2 tons of iron ore per person per year in Brazil, with a lot of damage when tailing dams go down, as has happened not so long ago. So then, this is the Atlas of Environmental Justice. Well, this is not the Atlas of Environmental Justice. This is a picture of the Atlas of Environmental Justice, in which there are many, many. It's not printed. It's in the web only. And each point means an environmental conflict. So another point I want to make, hoping still that I am within the analytical clarity description that was made, between the link between the metabolism, the complaints against the metabolism in the form of what they call ecological distribution conflicts, with Martin O'Connor and other colleagues from the mid-90s, we said, no, we are economists or lapsed economists, and we realized that in the world there are this kind of type of social conflicts on the environment, which we cannot call economic distribution conflicts, because they are not expressed by the people in economic language. The people could say sometimes we want economic compensation, money compensation, or the mainstream economies would say these are unfortunate externalities that we will bring into price valuation. But you look at the people in Norway, for instance, in the Fosen conflict, in the Alta River conflict, in the Lofoten conflict, and some other conflicts that we have in the others, the activists, people, the people activists in the conflicts, they could be from Friends of Nature in Norway, they could be Sami people, they could be people like the one in the room, so intelligent citizens, and they have different languages of valuation. And we were discussing before in another session about whether people use the notion of sacredness or not. No, I think Holberg himself would have liked very much to put religion into this kind of social sciences discussion, but this is not the issue, whether we believe that some mountain or some river is religious or not. The question is if the people use this as an argument, and not just as an instrumental argument in a dispute, whether they really believe in this, and why shouldn't they believe that an Apu in the Andes with snow on the top for the time being is sacred, isn't it? Who are we to say this is not sacred? In Barcelona, many people think that the Sagrada Familia, which is a church, is sacred. Well, many people don't know. It's a very good tourist attraction and it's a money-making business. But apart from being a money-making business, it has an aspect of sacredness, clearly. All the archaeological values, finding archaeological remains, there are cultural values, isn't it? As some people in the audience are studying in depth. There are cultural values which it cannot be reduced to economic valuation unless it is by force, by law or by force. The force of the economies, the power of the economies, to at the service of business to impose this as a doctrine. So who are the protagonists of these ecological distribution conflicts that arise from the protagonists of the ecological, the conflicts arise from the growth and the changes in the social metabolism? These are ranking of the ones that appear in the atlas. At the top it says waste pickers, which are active in many places. They want to keep the right to use the waste from in India or many poor places, and we have like 80 cases, and a book is coming out by Federico de Maria on this, because many articles are coming out from the atlas, academic articles, but also some books now. And that at the bottom it says local EJOs, no, environmental justice organizations. And above this says neighbors, citizens, communities, no, which is a sort of mixed category. And before that says farmers, because we made a mistake, we should have put farmers and peasants, but we can change this. And on top of this it says local scientists, because scientists intervene quite often in the activists call scientists to help them. This happens quite often. And it appears in the cases that we classify in the others. And on top of this says indigenous people, and this is the 40% of protagonists who are indigenous, which I mentioned before. More or less, don't take these numbers too seriously. I mean, the others is a sample of many more conflicts. And it's not a well-made sample because some regions like China, for instance, are in the others, but they are underrepresented compared to the populations. And for instance, well, anyway, you can understand that we have more cases that we should in a representative sample from Latin America because of the easiness of having contacts with them. Another table I want to show from the others is about the commodities, because I started saying all these conflicts, or many, happen at the commodity extraction frontiers, like nickel, or palladium, I mentioned, or copper here, or lithium in Finland now, for instance, or rare earths in Greenland, for instance. No? Not yet the conflict, I think, in practical terms, but coming soon. And so these are the commodities, the ranking of the commodities which appear in the atlas, and land and water at the top, and then there are the other commodities ranked. And then since we have been doing the atlas for 12 years already, at the beginning we forgot to put some commodities like cobalt or graphite, for instance, or even we forgot fertilizers, which was really unforgettable to forget. Fertilizers meaning phosphorus and potash and potassium, and then which nickel, but doesn't matter because you have the others has a button function, how do you call this? Thing that you press the button and a word search function that allows you to find the commodities you are interested in where they appear in the others. including ilmenite for titanium, which I didn't know anything about this 5 years ago. It's still zircon, rutile, ilmenite. One expands one ignorance every day doing this kind of work, because they are more, not only the, well, some have some chemical friends who say, now the whole table of the periodic table, the whole periodic table is coming into the economy. Before it was in the faculty of chemistry now, and now the chemical engineers are bringing this into the economy, in part with the skills of the reality of the electrical transition, the rare earths, for instance. To tell the truth, 3 months ago we had a discussion in the team of the elders, because we had rare metals in the commodity. I said, this does not exist, it's called rare earths. And we learned a lot in 2 sessions about rare earths. And then another table I want to show is the table of the corporations which are active. And these are top 100 ones. And again, what one can notice easily is that neither Bill Gates or whatever, Microsoft or Google or these companies are on top, because, well, they are, of course, extractivist in some other sense, isn't it? They extract money from me. In fact, I pay a little bit to Google every month. But they are not physically extractivist, or at least probably they are also. But they don't appear in the conflicts. They should appear in another type of conflicts, perhaps, not in the environmental, ecological distribution conflicts. So this is just to give you a taste about the others. And then in the next very few minutes, 2 minutes, I will talk about 2 issues. One is the growth in practice, which I already mentioned. The growth in practice, I say, because I think that many people are interested in here, and it was announced that there was a precursor of the growth or a figure of the growth. I am not a figure of the growth. They are younger people than myself. And precursor, Georgescu Regan was a precursor of the growth, of Herman Daly. But it's a movement which is growing intellectually and potentially even socially in Europe. But I said already before that I think more interesting that, well, no, as interesting as the European Union is the reality in Europe, the girls in the Lützerath Bleib movement a few months ago in the Rhineland in German, no? Lützerath Bleib, or the people in the Soulèvement de la Terre in France now, no? Or the Sadist in France, the zone at the front in the airport in Nantes. This in the north. But in the south is full of groups which are fighting against environmental depredation for their own interest, for their own livelihood, but also according to their own social values. Not only sacredness, other values like, well, traditions or whatever values, social values they have, but also, of course, for their interests. And this could be brought together in this idea of the growth in practice. For instance, the whole movement of Leave Fossil Fuels Underground, which has an acronym, LFFU, comes from Leave Oil in the Soil, from Nimo Basse and his friends in Nigeria against the Shell Company, already in the 1990s, together with Ecuador, with Acción Ecológica, Leave Oil in the Soil in the Yasuní, which was a very good idea, although it failed. So there are many movements around the world which can be classified with this acronym coming from the south of Leave Fossil Fuels Underground. So Lofoten is free riding from the point of view of idea on this kind of ideas from the south. And then the last one I want to show is this. Where does this discussion fit in social history or in history in general? If one believes, as all people like myself tend to believe still, perhaps, that history has some sense, or at least some, well, I'm sure that one finds all kinds of philosophers with different opinions about this. But the one thing, or one would like to think, that history can be progressing in a good sense, which is difficult to believe in the last year after the start of the Ukraine war, in which we see, I think, the world going back to a kind of age of empires, in which empires are going to fight each other. Nobody knows exactly why. Perhaps in some cases with regional small nuclear wars, which is small is the optimist's view. So if the world is moving into this, then all this is superfluous. If the world society, human society, is moving into what used to be called progress, is going to be better than it is now, this is very relevant. This is very relevant, and I copy this from Sera Yassin, who is a Kurdish young historian in Ankara, who wrote about the oil industry in Mosul, in Forefizes, and knows a lot about social metabolism and pipelines. And she says, summarizing, that in the last 100 to 20 years, there has been what we used to be called the social question, which I understand that in Norway, no, in the 20s, or 1910s, 20s, you had a lot of class struggle and unions, and everywhere else, not to speak of Barcelona, for instance. The social question was trade unions, working class, which of course still exists. Go to Bangladesh, go to China, go to India, isn't it? Ill-paid people. Then you have the agrarian question, which also exists. Look at the MST in Brazil. You have more and more, the, I don't know how to call it exactly, the gender question with feminists, which in my life as a human being and a man has been growing, 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 and does not stop growing, even, for instance, in Iran recently. Not just the movement, the open manifestation of this movement. Because one thing that Sera Yassin says, which I find interesting, that one should look at this little table from the movements to the questions, not to the questions, to the movement. First the movements and then the question, the name for the question. There was the urban question, which is a book by Manuel Castells, from already when he must have been 26 years old, when he published this book about the urban question, which means how much rent you have to pay, who is the owner of the houses in Bergen, for instance, no? And this is the urban question. You have the coloniality racism question, and what she puts as a new name, which I like very much, is this idea of the socio-ecological question, which overlaps with the other questions. Overlaps. So we are in the Anthropocene, we are in the Entropocene with an E, Anthropocene, and we are also in the age of the socio-ecological question, and what I'm discussing here is what kind of outcomes this might have. Thank you very much.